Israeli troops kill a 14-year-old Palestinian boy during a raid in the occupied West Bank. German Defense Minister Christine Lambrecht resigns amid pressure over her lackluster response to the Ukraine war and failure to improve the country's armed forces. And the British Prime Minister is announcing new proposals to clamp down on protests by giving the police more powers to prevent serious disruption. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behr Zajafik. Good to have you with us. The Israeli bloodshed against Palestinians shows no sign of abating. Regime forces have killed yet one more teenager in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry is saying the 14-year-old Omar Lotfi Komor was shot in the head in an Israeli raid into a refugee camp south of the city of Bethlehem. He was pronounced dead in the hospital. Israeli forces entered the Daisha camp and search and arrest of activists. They resorted to live fire on a group of youths who were pelting stones in reaction to the raid. Komor is the fourth child among 14 Palestinians killed by regime forces since the beginning of the year. Last year, they killed some 150 Palestinians in the West Bank alone. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kendall joined us earlier with details on the Israeli bloodshed in the occupied West Bank on an almost daily basis.
Israeli troops raided a Daesh refugee camp in Bethlehem, according to the Israeli military, in order to arrest Palestinians for throwing stones and rocks at the Israeli armored military jeeps. Clashes erupted, or Israeli forces used fired stun grenades and tear gas at the first at the Palestinian youths and children in order to disperse the protesters who were protesting the raid to a Daesh refugee camp. Then the Israeli forces used their live ammunition. They opened fire at the Palestinian youths, and they wounded the 14-year-old Omar Al-Khmour. Later, he succumbed to his injuries. Those Palestinians had done nothing. The Israelis are the ones who are raiding the Palestinian areas. They are using their arms and their weapons in order to arrest people. And in case the people and the Palestinians protest the illegal and the harsh incursion to their areas, then the Israeli soldiers use their arms and they are quick to pull the trigger to kill Palestinians in cold blood. Human rights organizations had even accused the Israeli forces for carrying out field executions against Palestinians, including Palestinian minors.
Now, meanwhile, Israeli forces have destroyed several Palestinian-owned shops in the occupied West Bank as the regime is pushing its land grab policy in the Palestinian territories. Now, the latest took place in the town of Hizma, northeast of Al-Quds. The shops were located near a military checkpoint. Israel also raised 10 Palestinian-owned workshops in the area a year ago. The regime routinely destroys Palestinian property for lacking construction permits. Palestinians say that this is a pretext to seize their lands to allow the regime to expand its illegal settlements. Israel is witnessing unprecedented mass rallies. The focus is how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of Supreme Courts in its own favor. And this is amid the premier's attempt to dodge charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets in several cities, including Tel Aviv, Al-Quds, and Haifa, for the second consecutive week to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to implement changes to Israel's legal system and weaken the Supreme Court. The demonstration presents an early challenge to Netanyahu and his far-right minister, Etmar Ben-Gvir, who has ordered police to take tough action if protesters block roads or display Palestinian flags. In defiance of Ben-Gavir's call, some footage showed Palestinian flags on display. The crowd in Tel Aviv swelled to more than 80,000 people despite rainy weather there. Demonstrators, many covered by umbrellas, held signs and chanted slogans like criminal government or the end of democracy. But what were they protesting that gave way to such a large crowd to come out?
We would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime in the world, and we will not accept it and will fight for this democracy.
The focus of the protests was how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of the Supreme Court in its own favor. This as Netanyahu is trying to escape charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The situation has already angered Israeli officials, including the president. Herzog also warned that Israel faced, quote, a historic constitutional crisis over the contested judicial reform plan. But despite all that criticism, Netanyahu has pledged to complete legislating the reforms in a way that will correct what needs correcting, totally protect individual rights, as he claims, and restore the public's faith in the justice system that so much requires such reform. The legal changes could help Netanyahu evade eviction of corruption or even make his trial disappear entirely.
Israel is grappling with numerous issues. It's facing the challenge posed by the rise of new Palestinian resistance groups, as well as a biting cost of living crisis and internal political division. Now, all these raises point to the question whether Israel is riding for a fall, especially seeing the comments by former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who warned in May that the regime could disintegrate before its 80th anniversary.
In office for more than just 2 weeks, Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet has launched proposals to weaken the Supreme Court by giving parliament the power to overturn court decisions with a simple majority vote. It also wants to give parliament control over the appointment of judges and reduce the independence of legal advisors. Israeli opposition leaders, former attorneys general, and the president of Israel's Supreme Court have all spoken out against the plan. They said the move would cripple judicial independence, foster corruption, set back minority rights, and deprive Israel's courts of credibility that helps fend off war crimes abroad. Critics said the changes could help Netanyahu evade conviction in his corruption trial or make the trial disappear altogether. But are these protests against Netanyahu himself? Netanyahu's premiership in the past has been fraught not only with trying to escape corruption charges, but also violations like Palestinian rights, settlement construction, and other hot-button issues that exist between Palestinians and Israel. Inside Israel, the opposition against the current right-wing cabinet and Netanyahu is so high and elevated that a new movement has been created to promote and encourage Israelis to leave Israel, with a group planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its project. Meanwhile, grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime. Den of Lions is one, an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the current right-wing cabinet and its far-right minister Ben-Gavir are advocating more violence against Palestinians, which would lead to more deaths, including violations like settlement buildings, changing the demographics of Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds, and other core issues. The cost of living is one other major issue protesters are angry with. After all, Israel is expensive and has one of the highest costs of living in the world. With all the crises the regime is grappling with, what seems to be on the corner for officials in Tel Aviv is what a protester said during the Saturday demonstration. "I came here to demonstrate against the anti-democratic steps of the new cabinet. This can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. Is this cabinet igniting the start of the end of Israel?" This exactly signifies what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak expressed concern about, the survival of Israel. Barak said the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. He said throughout the Jewish history, the Jews did not rule for more than 80 years, except in the two kingdoms of David and the Hasmonean dynasty. And in both periods, their disintegration began in the 8th decade. We'll be right back.
A Saudi academic is on death row for using social media as the Arab monarchy is tightening its grip on dissidents. Prominent pro-reform law professor Awad al-Qarni was arrested in September 2017, and that was part of a campaign of arrests that included at least 20 people. The alleged charges include owning a Twitter account and using WhatsApp to spread messages deemed hostile to the kingdom. Human rights advocates warning the regime is engaged in a new crackdown on free thinkers. That's while the Saudi government and state-controlled investors are raising their financial stakes in U.S. platforms like Twitter and Facebook. The use of social media has been criminalized within the country since the beginning of Mohammed bin Salman's reign. Now, we've asked writer and political analyst Saeed Shahabi for his take on the Saudi crackdown on dissent.
Nobody can say anything in Saudi Arabia, especially against the monarchy, against the Al Saud, the House of Saud. This is number one. Number two, they have the money and they think that by buying those big outlets, they will be able to silence the opposition. Number three, they are very harsh when dealing with anyone standing in their own way. Only 2 weeks ago, or less than that, we commemorated the martyrdom of Sheikh Nimr, who was executed by the regime in 2015 because of his outspoken criticism of the regime. Only today and yesterday, we were mourning, and we have been mourning the martyrdom of three Bahrainis who were also executed 4 years ago because of opposing the regime.
Yemeni Minister of Health has held a press conference in capital Sana'a declaring that the nation is running out of dialysis drugs and equipment needed to treat kidney failure. A correspondent, Yusuf Mowry, has more.
We attended a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Health in Sana'a, where it was declared that the Saudi-imposed blockade is causing a national health crisis by preventing entry of medicines and equipment for kidney failure patients. In the absence of dialysis treatment, approximately 5,000 patients on dialysis are at risk of dying, according to the health ministry.
The Saudi-led coalition targeted the health and medical sector from the very beginning of the war by directly destroying medical facilities, centers, hospitals, and medicine warehouses, and by imposing a blockade on every aspect of life through this siege that is being backed by America in order to control the country's health system.
Khalid Ahmed is one of the patients on dialysis, who is currently getting treatment at a Thota hospital. He said the lack of supplies has prevented him and other patients from receiving the required number of dialysis treatments per week.
We cannot eat much because we are only receiving two dialysis treatments a week instead of the required three treatments. As a result, we can only eat a bare minimum food.
But getting the required three treatments per week for Gayed and the other 5,000 patients like him is a near impossible task these days. This mixed solution, which is used to operate the dialysis machine, is in very short supply. There's only enough for two more weeks.
It's gotten so bad that we have to close down this section simply because we do not have enough supplies to run all of the dialysis machines. If we open this section, we would have no more supplies to treat patients. We've had to make emergency requests to other dialysis clinics to provide us with such equipment. By the end of January, we will be forced to close down because we'll have no more supplies to operate.
Unless the kidney disease center at Thota Hospital is supplied with dialysis filters and the solution needed to operate dialysis machines, they will be forced to shut down by the end of January. If that happens, the lives of approximately 5,000 patients will be at risk. The Yemeni army has repeatedly warned that if the Saudi-imposed blockade is not lifted, it would be forced to take military action. The siege must be ended so that much-needed medicine and other essential supplies can enter the country. Yusuf Mowry, Sana'a.
In other news, Russia is slamming the UK's decision to supply Ukraine with main battle tanks as well as other advanced artillery systems in the coming weeks. Kremlin spokesman says that the Western allies of Ukraine are using the country as a tool to achieve their anti-Russia agenda. Dmytro Peskov says the new arms supplies from countries like Britain and Poland would not change the situation on the ground. He rejected the allegation that Russian missiles are targeting residential buildings. He added that the situation in Dnipro is the result of Ukraine's counter-missile attacks. Since the beginning of Russia's offensive in Ukraine almost a year ago, the U.S. and Europe have provided to Kiev with billions of dollars of arms and military equipment. They've also imposed a wave of unprecedented economic sanctions on Moscow. The German defense minister resigns after months of criticism over her lackluster response to the war in Ukraine and failure to boost Germany's own armed forces. Christine Lambrusch quit just days before a crucial meeting of defense ministers from Ukrainian allies. A spokeswoman for Chancellor Olaf Scholz said that he would announce a replacement for Lambrusch in the near future. The resignation is made as a U.S.-led NATO alliance is under increasing pressure to deliver more weapons to Ukraine to help it fight Russia. Lambrusch had been criticized for a series of failures since taking office in 2021, especially over what critics say the country's ill-equipped army. She was also rebuked for not heeding to Ukraine's calls for heavy weapons. Even before the Ukraine war, Lambrusch was mocked for her statement that Germany would send 5,000 helmets to Kiev. Staying with Europe, the British government has set forth to put forth new proposals for quell public protests by giving the police more powers to prevent serious disruption. The government passed legislation to address the issue last year, but is planning to go further with a new set of laws known as the Public Order Bill that's being debated in Parliament. The government wants to amend the bill before it becomes law, and that in order to broaden the power of the police to deal with demonstrators who block traffic or lock themselves to objects or buildings. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has defended the new proposals, saying that protests by a small minority should not affect other citizens. Civil rights groups have warned that the legislation would be against democracy if passed by Parliament. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
I just told you that all options are on the table.
I have said repeatedly, and I will say today, we are not taking any options off the table.
Rest assured, we will take no options off the table.
No options off the table means I'm considering all options.
What those options might be?
No.
The assassination option.
Somebody is killing Iranian nuclear scientists. Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan murdered along with his driver in broad daylight in Tehran traffic.
One of Iran's top nuclear scientists has been killed in a car bombing in the capital, Tehran.
Two motorcyclists tracked the car through Tehran's morning rush hour, lobbing a magnetic bomb right at Roshan. A mission that seemed right out of a spy thriller like Syriana.
It has all the earmarks of an Israeli operation, very sophisticated, very particular, and very effective.
People are killing Iranian nuclear scientists in a very clear pattern. Sir, who do you think is behind it?
We believe that these terrorist attacks are supported by some elements in the, especially within the Israeli regime, as well as some quarters around the world.
And what about Israel? What reaction today?
You know, Diane, we've been looking for responses from Israel all day, and where did we find it? Facebook, with the Israeli Defense Force spokesman saying, I don't know who settled the score with the Iranian scientist, but I am certainly not shedding a tear, not exactly a denial there.
Nuclear scientist Dariush Rezai Nejad was assassinated on the 23rd of July 2011. On the afternoon he died, his wife and five-year-old daughter were in the car with him. He was 32. Fereydoon Abbasi was attacked on the 29th of November 2010 as head of Iran's Atomic Energy Agency on his way to the university where he taught nuclear physics. The 53-year-old survived the attack. He says the fact that Iranian scientists are asked to give so much personal information when they travel speaks volumes in itself. On the same day, and at almost exactly the same time, another assassination attack was being launched on the other side of town. 40-year-old Majid Shahriari was the target. He and his wife were on their way to the university where they both taught when a bomb was attached to their car. Shahriari was killed, his wife survived, but with serious injuries. She still bears the scars of that day. She says before the attack, they had received many death threats. In the past years, there have been five assassination attacks targeting Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran. Four were successful and one failed. The number of attacks and the way they were launched show a trend. So what entity or entities are responsible for these attacks?
Maximum covert operations to block and disrupt the Iranian program, including taking out their scientists, including breaking up their systems, all of it covertly, all of it deniable. Second, maximum coordination with the Israelis, in a way which allows them to maximize their impact in Iran. Third, absolute strategic program comparable to what President Reagan, Pope John Paul II, and Margaret Thatcher did to the Soviet Union, of every possible aspect short of war, of breaking the regime and bringing it down.
Mark Perry is an American intelligence and foreign affairs analyst based in Washington.
These are sophisticated operations. They're not suicide bombings. The most recent incident was a magnetic bomb, so I would say it's clear that it was an outside intelligence agency. And Leon Panetta, our Secretary of Defense, has said he has a pretty good idea of who did it, and I think he was hinting that it was the Israelis.
Iran has been threatened and sanctioned over its nuclear energy program. Five assassination attacks have been launched on Iranian nuclear scientists, and now the drums of war can be heard coming from the West. So are the countries pressuring Iran really worried about Iran having nuclear power? Or is the problem something else?
Get more on this now from RT's Peter Oliver. Peter, what exactly did Vladimir Putin say?
Well, he was really addressing his standpoint on key foreign policy issues. Iran was also on the lips of the Prime Minister. For a few years now, we've seen criticism of Russia's decision to build a nuclear power plant in Iran. Vladimir Putin saying this, The allegations that Iran was developing nuclear weapons was being used as an excuse to try and initiate regime change in the country.
Public perception is very important in all this. To take such drastic steps against another country, the nations involved have to be geared up to accept such an event. Iran's nuclear energy program has been the center of a lot of Western media attention. It's been labeled a nuclear weapons program, and Israeli director Alex Trayman has made a documentary called Iranium to brand that label on the public psyche.
Ronald Reagan helped a lot with the collapse of the Soviet Union by calling them an evil empire and saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's very much in the interests of the people of Iran, as well as all of Iran's neighbors and us, for us to do everything humanly possible to get this regime to collapse before it gets a nuclear weapon.
2 + 2 = 4. Israel feels threatened by Iran. It said it would do anything to protect its country. Unlike the United States, the Mossad does not have a prohibition against assassination. Clearly, they want to be able to react to the Iranian threat in any manner they can, up to and including assassinations.
Israel has kept quiet over the assassination of Iranian scientists, but the U.S., Israel's staunch supporter, has been quite vocal about the whole thing. U.S. presidential candidates say if that's what it takes, so be it.
You have to take whatever steps are necessary to break its capacity to have a nuclear weapon.
It appears obvious to me that the administration is doing little to nothing. Now, I'm hopeful that some of the things we're seeing with respect to the nuclear program that the United States is involved with, which is, on occasion, scientists working on the nuclear program in Iran turn up dead. I think that's a wonderful thing, candidly. I think we should send a very clear message that if you are a scientist from Russia or from North Korea or from Iran and you're going to work on the nuclear program to develop a nuclear bomb from Iran, you are not safe. And if people say, well, you can't go out and assassinate people, well, tell that to Milwaukee. Yeah. Okay? We've done it. We've done it for an American citizen.
I want to categorically deny any United States involvement in any kind of act of violence inside Iran.
Various entities are feeding off the political narrative surrounding Iran's nuclear program, from the media to weapons companies. It's a topic that has influenced global prices, is being used as a tool in elections, and even as an excuse for insurance companies that trade in and around Iran to push up prices. And certain groups that have also been fighting against the Iranian government for years have hooked their wagon up to this caravan.
Remember, this all started when we found them enriching uranium in an undeclared fashion. And it happened because somebody told on them. There was an Iranian group that brought forth the information.
A former United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq says Israel and the MKO are collaborating.
The question is, did that information, was it sourced by the MKO itself, or was the MKO used as a vehicle to provide this information to the public? There's reason to believe that in the case of the Natanz information, that this information was actually a product of a third agency, an outside party, Israel. Which developed this intelligence, and then Israel used the MKO as the vehicle to spread this information because of the MKO's past record of having intelligence information relevant to the Islamic Republic.
Do you believe that the Israelis are working with the People's Mujahideen of Iran? Do you believe Israel is working with Iranian dissidents?
I would say this: Iran is highly alert to the possibility of Israelis infiltrating it with false identities, trying to kill people, sabotage the Iranian nuclear project, and therefore it is very hard for Israelis to work in Iran. And it might that is that, unlike the history of most of the history of Israeli intelligence, where these operations were conducted on a, quote, blue and white principle, which is the colors of the flags of Israel, meaning only Israeli citizens, only Jews participate in such an operation. Maybe in Iran, the case is different because Iran is a different territory and very hard to work in. When you got such a territory, you might think to recruit locals upon your own people.
By its own admission, the West considers all the options to be on the table. Threats, sanctions, assassinations, and now the drums of war. Iran says Western think tanks are employing rather feeble strategies and are grossly mistaken in their calculations regarding Iran and the Iranian nation. Of course, the tactics being used against Iran can only succeed if the international community buys into all the hype and propaganda surrounding Iran.
You take a look at Iran and you realize that there's a number of patterns in place that are the exact replica of what had occurred with Iraq. I realized that the United States was playing the exact same game with Iran, manufacturing an artificial crisis over Iran's nuclear weapons program. And then you have a track record of the United States exaggerating the case of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and now you take a look at the case they're making with Iran, and you realize that the same pattern is at play, that the United States is manufacturing a false premise for confronting Iran. For what reason? Regime change.
Mind you, the international community did just that back in 2001 and 2003, when the West attacked Afghanistan and Iraq.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, Ya Ilahi wa Sayyidi wa Mawlaya wa Malik Irqi, Ya Man Biyadihi Nasiyati, Ya Ali Man Bidhurri wa Maskanati, Ya Khabiran Bifakri wa Faqati.
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we have reached this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication, in which the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, states, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, My Lord, My Lord, My Lord. Ya Ilahi wa Sayyidi wa Mawlai. My Allah, my Master and my Protector. Wa Malika Riqqi, O Owner of my Bondage. Ya Man Biyadihi Nasiyati. O He in whose hand is my forelock. Ya Aliman Bidurri wa Maskanati. O He who knows my affliction and my misery. Ya Khabiran Bifakri wa Faqati. O He who is aware of my poverty and my indigence. This is how Imam Ali alayhi salam starts this part of the Kumail supplication, in order to ask for forgiveness, in order to ask for accepting his repentance. Imam Ali alayhi salam starts with the word Rabb, and not just mentioning it once, but three times. Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabb. That's why it has been mentioned in our traditions and by some of the righteous favorite servants of the Almighty Allah that this is the chief name. This is probably the word Rabb is Allah's exalted name. Anyway, Imam Ali alayhi salam starts this by describing the Lord he has come to know. Ya man biyadihi nasiyati, O He in whose hand is my forelock. Ya aliman bidhurri wa maskanati. O He who knows my affliction and my misery. This means that although you are aware of my misery, of my challenges, of my difficulties I'm facing in my life, but since you are the creator and you yourself have told us to call for you, udu'uni, this is what I'm doing here. I know you are aware of everything because you are the absolute cause, but I'm listening to you. Ya aliman bi dhurri wa maskanati. Ya khabiran bi faqri wa faqati. Oh, the one who is aware of my poverty and my indigence. You know, you are aware of my indigence. And more important than that, I have come to know myself as someone who is totally in need of you. This is how Imam Ali alayhi salam starts this part.
And who is aware of my suffering and poverty? Oh, he who knows my destitution and starvation.
Thank you, Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. Feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So the prophets, the imams, Almighty Allah's favorite servants, have always been asking the Almighty Allah to forgive them. They have been aware of the fact that no one is accepted in Allah's presence without having deeds. So Imam Ali alayhi salam first comes to Allah with his deeds. They have come to know one more thing as well, that no one is accepted in his presence with deeds only and nothing else. Other necessary characteristics are needed. As the Holy Quran and some of the traditions mention, they are belief and sincerity, without which I assume no one is going to be subjected to Allah's mercy. So, the favorite servants paid much attention to having good deeds as well as these necessary conditions and prerequisites for the acceptance of deeds. And they performed their deeds as they should, and then they have come to request Allah to accept their deeds. The Holy Quran and the traditions imply that a deed is accepted only provided that its performer has belief in Allah and does it for the sake of Allah and in accord with the divine rules. This means prior to action, you need to have faith, you need belief, you need to know the Lord of the universe to whom you are sending your deeds. It should be pointed out that the believing servant's deed is accepted and his sin is forgiven in this case, but the deed of a disbelieving servant, however great and worthy it might be, is not accepted. And his sin, however tiny it might be, is not forgiven. This is the importance of belief in the system of the true Muslims. There are some important traditions narrated about worthy deeds together with its most valuable conditions in Shi'i books. And we will, in the next program, try to mention and discuss some of these so that we will be aware of how the Almighty Allah will forgive us if we have presented Him all our deeds and asked him to forgive our sins. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The recent riots in Brazil affected by political virus from Washington further weaken U.S. democracy. These riots were so familiar to those who observed the U.S. Capitol riots. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote in this regard, the riots in Brasilia have petered out, but the conundrums facing Washington are just beginning to bubble up. On January 8, supporters of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who refused to accept the results of the presidential election, stormed the country's Congress, Supreme Court, and the presidential palace. The scene is exactly the same as the one which followed the U.S. presidential election 2 years ago. More interestingly, Bolsonaro's governing style had kept itself consistent with that of former U.S. President Donald Trump in recent years. In terms of foreign policy, he aimed at pleasing his political base. In his views, domestic interests are more important than global responsibilities. He followed the decisions of the White House on a number of regional and international affairs. In his last days in office, Bolsonaro flew to Florida and was absent from the inauguration ceremony of Lula da Silva. The self-described definition of identity on whose Twitter account is still President of the Federative Republic of Brazil. On the next day of the Brazilian version of Capitol riots, Bolsonaro tweeted a photo showing himself lying on a hospital bed in Orlando, Florida, eager to disassociate himself from the vicious incident. The former president had repeatedly claimed Brazil's voting system is riddled with fraud and challenged the election he lost. After losing the election, angry Bolsonaro supporters staged protests in many places in Brazil. Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas accused Brazil's former leader of following Trump's playbook by using false claims of a rigged election to incite his supporters and cast doubt over the outcomes of a presidential election. Whether Bolsonaro has any connections with the riots is not important. One thing is undeniable. Trump virus, a variant of U.S. democracy, has undermined Brazil. Lula has kickstarted his third term as president 12 years after his last presidency. In his first two terms, he dropped the neoliberal development model in the economic field, safeguarded the interests of lower-class civilians politically, promoted social justice, and opposed the U.S. Monroe Doctrine, which sees Latin America as U.S. backyard diplomatically. At one point, like Hugo Chavez, he was an iconic figure in Latin Americans' pink tide or the turn to the left political wave. Lula's clear stance of being revolutionary, independent, and anti-American won widespread favor among the domestic people. He not only won the only re-election since the Brazilian military returned power to the people, but also brought the country into an unprecedentedly strong development cycle. Inevitably, he was also regarded as a thorn in the side of domestic and foreign forces who tried their best to maintain the old order. It is obviously not in the diplomatic interest of the U.S. regime, nor in line with the U.S. so-called values, for such an iconic figure of the Latin American left wing, who has a clear political background and conforms to broad public opinion, to regain the presidency. However, the White House has completely sided with Lula on the issue of Brasilia riots. Not only did U.S. President Joe Biden immediately express his desire to stand with the Brazilian people on Twitter, but he also issued a brief but clear-cut joint statement with the leaders of Canada and Mexico. Such enthusiastic support for left-wing leaders has amazed international public opinion. The value diplomacy emphasized by the Democratic Party appears to be worthless in this issue. It has made the world understand once again that no matter how U.S. foreign policy is decorated, it cannot escape the womb of double standards. On Capitol Hill, there are significant divisions in line with the executive branch. They control lawmakers from the Democratic Party, took all their anger over the January 6 riots out on Bolsonaro. However, the vast majority of lawmakers in the Republican Party opted for selective avoidance, and some have cautiously questioned the demand of ejecting Bolsonaro from the U.S. If the legislative branch no longer allows the executive branch to exercise discretion on the issue of whether he will leave or stay, American democracy will start a new round of mutation. Meanwhile, RT wrote in an op-ed, just as the U.S. was preparing for the second anniversary of its January 6th insurrection, ex-Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro went to Florida following election fallout in his own country. Of all the places in the world, Jair Bolsonaro could have led to following his tumultuous defeat in a runoff election against his left-wing opponent, Luis Inácio Lula da Silva. The United States may have been the least expected. After all, here is a country that most wanted men think Julian Assange and Edward Snowden escaped from, not to. Meanwhile, memories of its own so-called insurrection are still fresh in the minds of many Americans, some of whom are now holding the slippery reins of power. On January 6, 2021, following the defeat of then-US President Donald Trump in 2020 presidential election, a throng of his supporters descended upon the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., in the belief that the election had been stolen. A similar script played out recently in Brasilia, the Brazilian capital, as Bolsonaro supporters ransacked Congress and the Supreme Court and surrounded the presidential palace in yet another check in the armor of computer-controlled elections. The violence, which the former right-wing president formally condemned, forced Lula to call for a state of emergency in the capital until January 31st. By comparison, although Trump quickly committed himself to an orderly transition of power, Bolsonaro didn't stick around to hand over the ceremonial presidential sash to Lula da Silva at the inauguration, a bold decision that the new Brazilian leader will not soon forget or forgive. Rather than stepping aside, the former Brazilian incumbent fled to the Republican stronghold of Florida, which was certainly no accident considering that the Sunshine State is home to both Donald Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. This may prove invaluable should Lula make an extradition request for Bolsonaro. It would probably come as no surprise that the Democrats, a party that never misses a chance to change in political theater, are already doing exactly that. In the short term, Bolsonaro's American rendezvous shields him from any immediate legal tangles in Brazil, where he is under investigation in at least four criminal inquiries. But it goes without saying that Da Silva, who was in prison during Bolsonaro's 2019 inauguration on graft convictions that were later dismissed, would like nothing more than to exact some poetic justice on his ideological nemesis. That much was obvious in a thinly veiled threat Lula delivered to his predecessor.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.